Edison on the Road, A Bridge from Edison, His Life and Inventions, by Frank Lewis Dyer and Thomas Comerford Martin. In 1903, when accepting the position of honorary electrician to the International Exposition held in St. Louis in 1904, to commemorate the centenary of the Louisiana Purchase, Mr. Edison spoke in his letter of the Central West as a region where, as a young telegraph operator, I spent many arduous years before moving east. The term of probation thus referred to did not end until 1868, and while it lasted, Edison's wanderings carried him from Detroit to New Orleans, and took him, among other cities, to Indianapolis, Cincinnati, Louisville, and Memphis, some of which he visited twice in his effort to secure work. After leaving my first job at Stratford Junction, I got a position as operator on the Lake Shore in Michigan Southern at Adrian, Michigan, in the division superintendent's office. As usual, I took the night trick, which most operators disliked, but which I preferred, as it gave me more leisure to experiment. I had obtained from the station agent a small room and had established a little shop of my own. One day, the day operator wanted to get off, and I was on duty. About 9 o'clock, the superintendent handed me a dispatch, which he said was very important and which I must get off at once. The wire at the time was very busy, and I asked if I should break in. I got orders to do so, and acting under those orders of the superintendent, I broke in and tried to send the dispatch. But the other operator would not permit it, and the struggle continued for 10 minutes. Finally, I got possession of the wire and sent the message. The superintendent of telegraph, who then lived in Adrian and went to his office in Toledo every day, happened that day to be in the Western Union office uptown, and it was the superintendent I was really struggling with. In about 20 minutes he arrived, livid with rage, and I was discharged on the spot. I informed him that the general superintendent had told me to break in and send the dispatch. But the general superintendent then and there repudiated the whole thing. Their families were socially close, so I was sacrificed. My faith in human nature got a slight jar. He drifted later to Indianapolis, arriving there in the fall of 1864, when he was first assigned to duty at the Union Station at a salary of $75 a month for the Western Union Telegraph Company, whose service he now entered and with which he has been destined to maintain highly important and close relationships through a large part of his life. Edison did not stay long in Indianapolis, however, resigning in February 1865 and proceeding to Cincinnati. The transfer was possibly due to trouble caused by one of his early inventions embodying what has been characterized by an expert as probably the most simple and ingenious arrangement of connections for a repeater. His ambition was to take press report, but finding, even after considerable practice, that he broke frequently, he adjusted 2 embossing Morse registers, one to receive the press matter, and the other to repeat the dots and dashes at a lower speed, so that the message could be copied leisurely. Hence he could not be rushed or broken in receiving, while he could turn out copy that was a marvel of neatness and clearness. All was well as long as ordinary conditions prevailed, but when an unusual pressure occurred, the little system fell behind, and the newspapers complained of the slowness with which reports were delivered to them. It is easy to understand that with matter received at a rate of 40 words per minute and worked off at 25 words a minute, a serious congestion or delay would result, and the newspapers were more anxious for the news than they were for fine penmanship. Of this device, Mr. Edison remarks, "Together we took press for several nights, my companion keeping the apparatus in adjustment and I copying. The regular press operator would go off to the theater or take a nap, only finishing the report after 1 a.m. One of the newspapers complained of bad copy toward the end of the report, that is, from 1 to 3 a.m., and requested that the operator taking the report up to 1 a.m., which was ourselves, take it all, as the copy then was perfectly unobjectionable. This led to an investigation by the manager, and the scheme was forbidden. The instrument many years afterward was applied by me for transferring messages from one wire to any other wire simultaneously or after any interval of time. It consisted of a disk of paper, the indentations being formed in a volute spiral exactly as in the disk phonograph today. It was this instrument which gave me the idea of the phonograph while working on the telephone. Arriving in Cincinnati, where he got employment in the Western Union Commercial Telegraph Department at a wage of $60 per month, Edison made the acquaintance of Milton F. Adams, already referred to as Facile Princeps, the typical telegrapher in all his more sociable and brilliant aspects. "Speaking of that time," Mr. Adams says, "I can well recall when Edison drifted in to take a job. He was a youth of about 18 years, decidedly unprepossessing in dress and rather uncouth in manner. I was 21 and very dudish. He was quite thin in those days, and his nose was very prominent, giving a Napoleonic look to his face, although the curious resemblance did not strike me at the time. The boys did not take to him cheerfully, and he was lonesome. I sympathized with him, and we became close companions. As an operator, he had no superiors and very few equals. Most of the time, he was monkeying with the batteries and circuits and devising things to make the work of telegraphy less irksome. He also relieved the monotony of the office by fitting up the battery circuits to play jokes on his fellow operators and to deal with the vermin that infested the premises. He arranged in the cellar what he called his rat paralyzer, a very simple contrivance consisting of two plates insulated from each other and connected with the main battery. They were so placed that when a rat passed over them, the forefeet on the one plate and the hind feet on the other completed the circuit, and the rat departed this life electrocuted. Shortly after Edison arrived at Cincinnati came the close of the Civil War and the assassination of President Lincoln. It was natural that telegraphers should take an intense interest in the general struggle, for not only did they handle all the news relating to it, but many of them were at one time or another personal participants. For example, one of the operators in the Cincinnati office was George Ellsworth, who was a telegrapher for Morgan, the famous Southern guerrilla, and was with him when he made his raid into Ohio and was captured near the Pennsylvania line. Ellsworth himself made a narrow escape by swimming the Ohio River with the aid of an army mule. Yet we can well appreciate the unimpressionable way in which some of the men did their work, from an anecdote that Edison tells of that awful night of February, April 14, 1865. "I noticed," he says, "an immense crowd gathering in the street outside a newspaper office. I called the attention of the other operators to the crowd, and we sent a messenger boy to find the cause of the excitement. He returned in a few minutes and shouted, 'Lincoln shot.' Instinctively, the operators looked from one face to another to see which man had received the news. All the faces were blank, and every man said he had not taken a word about the shooting. 'Look in your files,' said the boss to the man handling the press stuff. For a few minutes we waited in suspense, and then the man held up a sheet of paper containing a short account of the shooting of the president. The operator had worked so mechanically that he had handled the news without the slightest knowledge of its significance." Mr. Adams says that at the time the city was in fete on account of the close of the war, the name of the assassin was received by telegraph, and it was noted with a thrill of horror that it was that of a brother of Edmund Booth and of Junius Brutus Booth, the latter of whom was then playing at the old National Theater. Booth was hurried away into seclusion, and the next morning the city that had been so gay overnight with bunting was draped with mourning. Edison's diversions in Cincinnati were chiefly those already noted. He read a great deal, but spent most of his leisure in experiment. Edison and I were very fond of tragedy. Forrest and John McCullough were playing at the National Theater, and when our capital was sufficient, we would go to see these eminent traditions alternate as Othello and Iago. Edison always enjoyed Othello greatly. Aside from an occasional visit to the Lohengarten over the Rhine with a glass of beer and a few pretzels consumed while listening to the excellent music of a German band, the theater was the sum and substance of our innocent dissipation. He had previously been getting $80 a month, and had eked this out by copying plays for the theater. His rating was that of a plug or inferior operator, but he was determined to lift himself into the class of first-class operators, and had kept up the practice of going to the office at night to copy press, acting willingly as a substitute for any operator who wanted to get off for a few hours, which often meant all night. Speaking of the special ordeal for which he had thus been unconsciously preparing, Edison says, "My copy looked fine if viewed as a whole, as I would write a perfectly straight line across the wide sheet which was not ruled. There were no flourishes, but the individual letters would not bear close inspection. When I missed understanding a word, there was no time to think what it was, so I made an illegible one to fill in, trusting to the printers to sense it. I knew they could read anything, although Mr. Bloss, an editor of the Inquirer, made such bad copy that one of his editorials was pasted up on a notice board in the telegraph office with an offer of $1 to any man who could read 20 consecutive words. Nobody ever did it. When I got through, I was too nervous to go home, so waited the rest of the night for the day manager, Mr. Stevens, to see what was to be the outcome of this union formation and of my efforts. He was an austere man, and I was afraid of him. I got the morning paper, which came out at 4 a.m., and the press report read perfectly, which surprised me greatly. I went to work on my regular day wire to Portsmouth, Ohio, and there was considerable excitement, but nothing was said to me. Neither did Mr. Stevens examine the copy on the office hook, which I was watching with great interest. However, about 3 p.m. he went to the hook, grabbed the bunch, and looked at it as a whole without examining it in detail, for which I was thankful. Then he jabbed it back on the hook, and I knew I was all right. He walked over to me and said, "Young man, I want you to work the Louisville night wires. Your salary will be $125. Thus I got from the plug classification to that of a first-class man. But no sooner was this promotion secure than he started again on his wandering southward, while his friend Adams went north, neither having any difficulty in making the trip. The boys in those days had extraordinary facilities for travel. As a usual thing, it was only necessary for them to board a train and tell the conductor they were operators. Then they would go as far as they liked. The number of operators was small, and they were in demand everywhere. It was in this way Edison made his way south as far as Memphis, Tennessee, where the telegraph service at that time was under military law, although the operators received $125 a month. Here again Edison began to invent and improve on existing apparatus, with the result of having once more to move on. The story may be told in his own terse language. "I was not the inventor of the auto repeater, but while in Memphis I worked on one, learning that the chief operator, who was a protege of the superintendent, was trying in some way to put New York and New Orleans together for the first time since the close of the war. I redoubled my efforts, and at 2 o'clock one morning I had them speaking to each other. The office of the Memphis Avalanche was in the same building. The paper got wind of it and sent messages. A column came out in the morning about it, but when I went to the office in the afternoon to report for duty, I was discharged without an explanation. The superintendent would not even give me a pass to Nashville, so I had to pay my fare. I had so little money left that I nearly starved in Decatur, Alabama, and had to stay 3 days before going on north to Nashville. Arriving in that city, I went to the telegraph office, got money enough to buy a little solid food, and secured a pass to Louisville. I had a companion with me who was also out of a job. I arrived at Louisville on a bitterly cold day with ice in the gutters. I was wearing a linen duster and was not much to look at, but got a position at once, working on a press wire. My traveling companion was less successful on account of his record. Everything at that time was wide open. Disorganization reigned supreme. There was no head to anything. At night, myself and a companion would go over to a gloriously furnished faro bank and get our midnight lunch. Everything was free. There were over 20 kino rooms running. One of them that I visited was in a Baptist church, the man with the wheel being in the pulpit and the gamblers in the pews. While there, the manager of the telegraph office was arrested for something I never understood and incarcerated in a military prison about half a mile from the office. The building was in plain sight from the office and four stories high. He was kept strictly incommunicado. One day, thinking he might be confined in a room facing the office, I put my arm out of the window and kept signaling dots and dashes by the movement of the arm. I tried this several times for 2 days. Finally, he noticed it, and putting his arm through the bars of the window, he established communication with me. He thus sent several messages to his friends and was afterwards set free. Young Edison remained in Louisville for about 2 years, quite a long stay for one with such nomadic instincts. It was there that he perfected the peculiar vertical style of writing, which, beginning with him in telegraphy, later became so much of a fad with teachers of penmanship and in schools. He says of this form of writing, "I developed this style in Louisville while taking press reports. My wire was connected to the blind side of a repeater at Cincinnati, so that if I missed a word or sentence, or if the wire worked badly, I could not break in and get the last words, because the Cincinnati man had no instrument by which he could hear me. I had to take what came. When I got the job, the cable across the Ohio River at Covington, connecting to the line at Louisville, had a variable leak in it, which caused the strength of signaling current to make violent fluctuations. I obviated this by using several relays, each with a different adjustment, working several sounders, all connected with one sounding plate. The clatter was bad, but I could read it with fair ease. When, in addition to this infernal leak, the wires north to Cleveland worked badly, it required large amounts of imagination to get the sense of what was being sent. And imagination requires an appreciable time for its exercise, and as the stuff was coming at the rate of 35 to 40 words a minute, it was very difficult to write down what was coming and imagine what wasn't coming. Hence, it was necessary to become a very rapid writer, so I started to find the fastest style. I found that the vertical style, with each letter separate and without any flourishes, was the most rapid, and that the smaller the letter, the greater the rapidity. As I took on average from 8 to 15 columns of news report every day, it did not take long to perfect this method. Mr. Edison has adhered to this characteristic style of penmanship down to the present time. As a matter of fact, the conditions of Louisville at the time were not much better than they'd been at Memphis. The telegraph operating room was in deplorable condition. It was on the second story of a dilapidated building on the principal street of the city, with a battery room in the rear, behind which was the office of the agent of the Associated Press. The plastering was about one-third gone from the ceiling. A small stove used occasionally in the winter was connected to the chimney by a tortuous pipe. The office was never cleaned. The switchboard for manipulating the wires was about 34 inches square. The brass connections on it were black with age and with the arcing effects of lightning, which to young Edison seemed particularly partial to Louisville. It would strike on the wires, he says, with an explosion like a cannon shot, making the office no place for an operator with heart disease. Around the dingy walls were a dozen tables, the ends next to the wall. They were about the size of those in old-fashioned country hotels for holding the washbowl and pitcher. The copper wires connecting the instruments to the switchboard were small, crystallized, and rotten. The battery room was filled with old record books and message bundles and 100 cells of nitric acid battery arranged on a stand in the center of the room. The stand, as well as the floor, was almost eaten through by the destructive action of the powerful acid. Grim and uncompromising as the description reads, it was typical of the equipment in those remote days of the telegraph at the close of the war. Illustrative of the length to which telegraphers could go at a time when they were so much in demand, Edison tells the following story. When I took the position, there was a great shortage of operators. One night at 2 a.m., another operator and I were on duty. I was taking press report and the other man was working the New York wire. We heard a heavy tramp, tramp, tramp on the rickety stairs. Suddenly the door was thrown open with great violence, dislodging it from one of the hinges. There appeared in the doorway one of the best operators we had who worked daytime, and who was of a very quiet disposition except when intoxicated. He was a great friend of the manager of the office. His eyes were bloodshot and wild, and one sleeve had been torn away from his coat. Without noticing either of us, he went up to the stove and kicked it over. The stovepipe fell, dislocated at every joint. It was half full of exceedingly fine soot, which floated over and filled the room completely. This produced a momentary respite to his labors. When the atmosphere had cleared sufficiently to see, he went around and pulled every table from the wall, piling them on top of the stove in the middle of the room. Then he proceeded to pull the switchboard away from the wall. It was held tightly by screws. He succeeded finally, and when it gave way, he fell with the board and, striking on a table, cut himself so that he soon became covered with blood. He then went to the battery room and knocked all the batteries off on the floor. The nitric acid soon began to combine with the plaster in the room below, which was the public receiving room for messengers and bookkeepers. The excess acid poured through and ate up the account books. After having finished everything to his satisfaction, he left. I told the other operator to do nothing. We would leave things just as they were and wait until the manager came. In the meantime, as I knew all the wires coming through to the switchboard, I rigged up a temporary set of instruments so that the New York business could be cleared up, and we also got the remainder of the press matter. At 7 o'clock, the day men began to appear. They were told to go downstairs and wait the coming of the manager. At 8 o'clock, he appeared, walked around, went to the battery room, and then came to me, saying, "Edison, who did this?" I told him that Billy L. had come in full of soda water and invented the ruin before him. He walked backward and forward about a minute, then, coming up to my table, put his fist down and said, "If Billy L. ever does that again, I will discharge him." It was needless to say that there were other operators who took advantage of that kind of discipline, and I had many calls at night after that, but none with such destructive effects. Mr. Edison throws also a curious sidelight on the origin of the comic column in the modern American newspaper, the telegraph giving to a new joke or a good story the ubiquity and instantaneity of an important historic event. It was the practice of the press operators all over the country at that time, when a lull occurred, to start in and send jokes or stories the day men had collected, and these were copied and pasted up on the bulletin board. Cleveland was the originating office for press, which it received from New York and sent it out simultaneously to Milwaukee, Chicago, Toledo, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Columbus, Dayton, Cincinnati, Indianapolis, Vincennes, Terre Haute, St. Louis, and Louisville. Cleveland would call first on Milwaukee. If he had anything, if so, he would send it. And Cleveland would repeat it to us all. Thus, any joke or story originating anywhere in that area was known the next day all over. The pressmen would come in and copy anything which could be published, which was about 3%. I collected, too, quite a large scrapbook of it, but unfortunately have lost it. Drifting after a time from Louisville, Edison made his way as far north as Detroit, but soon made his way back again. Possibly the severe discipline after the happy-go-lucky regime in the southern city had something to do with this restlessness, which again manifested itself, however, on his return thither. The end of the war had left the South a scene of destruction and desolation, and many men who had fought bravely and well found it hard to reconcile themselves to the grim task of Reconstruction. Work was soon resumed at Louisville, where the dilapidated old office occupied at the close of the war had been exchanged for one much more comfortable and luxurious in its equipment. Edison was allotted a press report and remembers very distinctly taking the presidential message and veto of the District of Columbia bill by President Johnson. As the matter was received over the wire, he paragraphed it so that each printer had exactly 3 lines, thus enabling the matter to be set up very expeditiously in the newspaper offices. This earned him the gratitude of the editors, a dinner, and all the newspaper exchanges he wanted. Edison's accounts of the sprees and debauches of the other night operators in the loosely managed offices enable one to understand how even a little steady application to the work in hand would be appreciated. Edison seems on the whole to have been fairly comfortable and happy in Louisville, surrounding himself with books and experimental apparatus, and even inditing a treatise on electricity. But his very thirst for knowledge and new facts again proved his undoing. The instruments in the handsome new offices were fastened to their proper places, and operators were strictly forbidden to remove them or to use the batteries except on regular work. These prohibitions meant little to Edison, who had access to no other instruments except those of the company. "I went one night," he said, "into the battery room to obtain some sulfuric acid for experimenting. The carboy tipped over, the acid ran out, and went through to the manager's room below and ate up his desk and all the carpet. The next morning I was summoned before him and told that what the company wanted was operators, not experimenters. I was at liberty to take my pay and get out." The fact that Edison is a very studious man, an insatiable lover and reader of books, is well known to his associates. But surprise is often expressed at his fund of miscellaneous information. This, it will be seen, is partly explained by his work for years as a press reporter. He says of this, "The second time I was in Louisville, they had moved into a new office, and the discipline was now good. I took the press job. In fact, I was a very poor sender, and therefore made the taking of press report a specialty. The newspapermen allowed me to come over after going to press at 3 a.m. and get all the exchanges I wanted. These I would take home and lay on the foot of my bed. I never slept more than 4 or 5 hours, so that I would awake at 9 or 10 and read these papers until dinner time. I thus kept posted and knew from their activity every member of Congress and what committees they were on, and all about the topical doings, as well as the prices of breadstuffs in all the primary markets. I was in a much better position than most operators to call on my imagination to supply missing words or sentences, which were frequent in those days of old rotten wires, badly insulated, especially on stormy nights. Upon such occasions I had to supply in some cases 1/5 of the whole matter, pure guessing, but I got caught only once. There had been some kind of a convention in Virginia in which John Minor Butts was a leading figure. There was a great excitement about it, and 2 votes had been taken in the convention on the 2 days. There was no doubt that the vote the next day would go a certain way. A very bad storm came up about 10 o'clock, and my wires worked very badly. Then there was a cessation of all signals. Then I made out the words, 'Minor Butts.' The next was a New York item. I filled in a paragraph about the convention and how the vote had gone, as I was sure it would, but next day I learned that instead of there being a vote, the convention had adjourned without action until the day after. In like manner, it was at Louisville that Mr. Edison got an insight into the manner in which great political speeches are more frequently reported than the public suspects. The Associated Press had a shorthand man traveling with President Johnson when he made his celebrated swing around the circle in a private train delivering hot speeches in defense of his conduct. The man engaged me to write out the notes from his reading. He came in loaded and on the verge of incoherence. We started in, but about every 2 minutes I'd have to scratch out whole paragraphs and insert the same thing said in another and better way. He would frequently change words, always to the betterment of the speech. I couldn't understand this, and when he got through and I had copied about 3 columns, I asked him why those changes, if he read from notes. "Sonny," he said, "if these politicians had their speeches published as they deliver them, a great many shorthand writers would be out of a job. The best shorthanders and holders of good positions are those who can take a lot of rambling, incoherent stuff and make a rattling good speech out of it." Going back to Cincinnati and beginning his second term there as an operator, Edison found the office in new quarters with greatly improved management. He was again put on night duty, much to his satisfaction. He rented a room in the top floor of an office building, bought a cot and an oil stove, a foot lathe, and some tools. He cultivated the acquaintance of Mr. Summers, superintendent of the telegraph of the Cincinnati and Indianapolis Railroad, who gave him permission to take such scrap apparatus as he might desire that was of no use to the company. With Summers, on one occasion, he had an opportunity to indulge his always strong sense of humor. Summers was a very witty man, he says, and fond of experimenting. "We worked on a self-adjusting telegraph relay, which would have been very valuable if we could have got it. I soon became the possessor of a second-hand Runkhoff induction coil, which, although it would only give a small spark, would twist the arms and clutch the hands of a man so that he could not let go of the apparatus. One day we went down to the roundhouse of the Cincinnati and Indianapolis Railroad and connected up the long wash tank in that room with the coil, one electrode being connected to earth. Above this washroom was a flat roof. We bored a hole through the roof so we could see the men as they came in. The first man as he entered dipped his hands in the water. The floor being wet, he formed a circuit and up went his hands. He tried it the second time with the same result. He then stood against the wall with a puzzled expression. We surmised he was waiting for somebody else to come in, which occurred shortly after, with the same result. Then they went out, and the place was soon crowded, and there was considerable excitement. Various theories were broached to explain this curious phenomena. We enjoyed the sport immensely. It must be remembered that this was over 40 years ago, when there was no popular instruction in electricity, and when its possibilities for practical joking were known to only a very few. Today such a crowd of working men would be sure to include at least one student of a night school or correspondence courses who would explain the mystery offhand. Note has been made of the presence of Ellsworth in the Cincinnati office and his service with the Confederate guerrilla Morgan, for whom he tapped federal wires, read military messages, sent false ones, and did serious mischief generally. It's well known that one operator can recognize another by the way in which he makes his signals. It's his style of handwriting. Ellsworth possessed in a remarkable degree the skill of imitating these peculiarities, and thus he deceived the Union operators easily. Edison says that while apparently a quiet man in bearing, Ellsworth, after the excitement of fighting, found the tameness of a telegraph office obnoxious, and that he became a bad gunman in the panhandle of Texas, where he was killed. "We soon became acquainted," said Edison, "of this period in Cincinnati, and he wanted me to invent a secret method of sending dispatches so that an intermediate operator could not tap the wire and understand it. He said that if it could be accomplished, he could sell it to the government for a large sum of money. This suited me, and I started in and succeeded in making such an instrument, which had in it the germ of my quadruplex now used throughout the world, permitting the dispatch of 4 messages over 1 wire simultaneously. By the time I had succeeded in getting the apparatus to work, Ellsworth suddenly disappeared. Many years afterward, I used this little device again for the same purpose. At Menlo Park, New Jersey, I had my laboratory. There were several Western Union wires cut into the laboratory and used by me in experimenting at night. One day I sat near an instrument which I had left connected during the night. I soon found it was a private wire between New York and Philadelphia, and I heard among a lot of stuff a message that surprised me. A week after that, I had occasion to go to New York, and visiting the office of the lessee of the wire, I asked him if he hadn't sent such and such a message. The expression that came over his face was a sight. He asked me how I knew of any message. I told him the circumstances and suggested that he had better cipher such communications or put on a secret sounder. The result of the interview was that I installed for him my old Cincinnati apparatus, which was used thereafter for many years. Edison did not make a very long stay in Cincinnati this time, but went home after a while to Port Huron. Soon, tiring of idleness and isolation, he sent a cry from Macedonia to his old friend Milt Adams, who was in Boston, and whom he wished to rejoin if he could get work promptly in the East. Edison himself gives the details of this eventful move, when he went east to grow up with the new art of electricity. I'd left Louisville the second time and went home to see my parents. After stopping at home for some time, I got restless and I thought I'd like to work in the East. Knowing that a former operator named Adams, who'd worked with me in the Cincinnati office, was in Boston, I wrote him that I wanted a job there. He wrote back that if I came on immediately, he could get me in the Western Union office. I had helped out the Grand Trunk Railroad telegraph people by a new device when they lost one of the two submarine cables they had across the river, making the remaining one act just as well for their purpose as if they had two. I thought I was entitled to a pass, which they conceded, and I started for Boston. After leaving Toronto, a terrific blizzard came up, and the train got snowed under in a cut. After staying there 24 hours, the trainmen made snowshoes of fence rail splints and started out to find food, which they did about a half mile away. They found a roadside inn, and by means of snowshoes all the passengers were taken to the inn. The train reached Montreal 4 days late. A number of the passengers and myself went to the military headquarters to testify in favor of a soldier who was on furlough and was 2 days late, which was a serious matter with military people, I learned. We willingly did this, for this soldier was a great storyteller and made the time pass quickly. I met here a telegraph operator named Stanton, who took me to his boarding house, the most cheerless I've ever been in. Nobody got enough to eat, the bedclothes were too short and too thin. It was 28 degrees below zero, and the wash water was frozen solid. The board was cheap, being only $1.50 per week. Stanton said that the usual livestock accompaniment of operators' boarding houses was absent. He thought the intense cold had caused them to hibernate. Stanton, when I was working in Cincinnati, left his position and went out on the Union Railroad to work at Julesburg, which was a cattle town at that time and very tough. I remember seeing him off on the train, never expecting to see him again. 6 months afterward, while working press wire in Cincinnati about 2 a.m., there was flung into the middle of the operating room a large tin box. It made a report like a pistol, and we all jumped up, startled. In walked Stanton. "Gentlemen," he said, "I've just returned from a pleasure trip to the land beyond the Mississippi. All my wealth is contained in my metallic traveling case, and you are welcome to it." The case contained one paper collar. He sat down, and I noticed he had a woolen comforter around his neck with his coat buttoned closely. The night was intensely warm. He then opened his coat and revealed the fact that he had nothing but the bare skin. "Gentlemen," said he, "you see before you an operator who has reached the limit of impecuniosity." Not far from the limit of impecuniosity was Edison himself as he landed in Boston in 1868 after this wintry ordeal. This chapter has run to undue length, but it must not close without one citation from high authority as to the service of the Military Telegraph Corps so often referred to in it. General Grant, in his memoirs describing the movements of the Army of the Potomac, lays stress on the service of his telegraph operators and says, "Nothing could be more complete than the organization and discipline of this body of brave and intelligent men." Insulated wires were wound upon reels. 2 men and a mule detailed to each reel. The pack saddle was provided with a rack-like sawbuck, placed crosswise, so that the wheel would revolve freely. There was a wagon provided with a telegraph operator, battery and instruments for each division, corps, and army, and for my headquarters. Wagons were also loaded with light poles supplied with an iron spike at each end to hold the wires up. The moment troops were in position to go into camp, the men would put up their wires. Thus, in a few minutes longer than it took a mule to walk the length of its coil, telegraphic communications would be effected between all the headquarters of the army. No orders ever had to be given to establish the telegraph.